Coming up on Life is a Festival.
I see men in my life who have had a very impoverished experience of what their life can look like because they've only been given like two stories. And so I think we can be really compassionate to the people who identify as male in our lives, that they have not been given good stories to live out. So when they make bad decisions, it's because they were not given a lot of options. And, you know, when you have a gut that doesn't have a lot of microbes in it, a monologuing pathogen can take over. And the way you cure that is not by killing the monologuing pathogen, but by adding fermentation, adding probiotics, more stuff in, better stuff. And so I think that I want to give the masculine a big probiotic hug and say, you know, you need a lot more options. You need options that come from fungi, from lizards, from weather systems, from different cultures. We need to have holobiont masculinity stories. Holobiont meaning beings that are composed of other beings.
Welcome back to Life is a Festival, and happy summer solstice. It's apropos that we would release this episode on the summer solstice because I am speaking to the mistress of mycelial masculinity with her poignant mythopoetic perspectives. And it just seems to align so perfectly for this particular day. Sophie Strand is the author of The Flowering Wand, which is a collection of essays about healing masculinity. And healthy masculinity has been a passion of mine for many years, so it was an honor to learn from this neo-troubadour animist and her beautiful poetic insights. So during our discussion, we discuss the androgynous rock star Dionysus. We talk about modern misunderstandings of Odysseus and the theromorphic archetype of masculinity. Sophie elucidates why healing is always relational and the role of the festival in helping to, as she says, wed our wounds to the earth. Sophie's central thesis is that the trouble with masculinity is that it is like a gut dysbiosis, and what we need is to give the masculine a big probiotic hug. Sophie Strand is a Hudson Valley-based writer who explores the intersection of spirituality, storytelling, and ecology. She has authored a collection of essays titled The Flowering Wand. She also wrote The Madonna Secret, an eco-feminist historical fiction that reimagines the Gospels, which is available for purchase now. And now, without further ado, here is the brilliant Sophie Strand. Sophie, welcome to Life is a Festival. I think you are the most nominated person on this show.
I'm so honored.
I've had like a handful of people being like, you should talk to her. And now the time is right. I'm writing about masculinity at the moment. You have written a beautiful collection of essays about masculinity. Your approach to me is, I think sometimes it's hyperbolic to say groundbreaking, but I think groundbreaking works.
Well, maybe
it's
like ground planting. It's like very ground centric. So groundbreaking as a pun definitely works.
Well, I'm really inspired by this book. I'm inspired by your work. You've had beautiful conversations with mutual friends of ours, Ian McKenzie. You were on the Sacred Sons podcast. So it was only a matter of time before I tried to get you to put all this into festivals. So here we are. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And as someone who definitely thinks that life is a festival, who's very interested in kind of communal healing as being a concatenated communal experience, you know, this is definitely the right place for me to land.
I'm so happy. I'm going to set the table for something that we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. In my journey in festivals, particularly mm-hmm. Burning Man, festivals became a portal to the quote unquote healing journey for me. And it's hyper individualistic, consumptive sort of thing. And I think there's a reclamation of modern festivals into more communal healing and integrating into communities. So that's not where we'll start today, but I just want to foreshadow that that's one of my desires in this podcast, even just for my own self, to how to kind of like decouple this hyper-individualistic hero's journey healing process, which doesn't seem to work, and actually look at what communal healing looks like.
Well, we're very much in the same boat. I am finishing right now my memoir on complicating healing paradigms and healing narratives as they've been kind of polluted by this atomized individuality. of capitalism. So yeah, definitely something that's been on my mind lately.
Well, let's start playfully.
Okay.
Why do you love Dionysus so much?
Whew, why do I love Dionysus so much? So it's kind of a roundabout answer, which is I was raised by spiritual scholars who are really interested in a kind of interfaith compost deep approach. You know, I was raised with theologians, rabbis, Theravadan Buddhist monks, nuns, eco-anarchists all around the dinner table talking. Also like a couple of, you know, rehabilitated possums and geese. So the interspecies element was there as well. But, you know, my parents' interest as I grew up became focused on how Christianity becomes a tool of patriarchy and ecocide when it seems to start in a very different place. And so that was kind of a question that was part of my upbringing. And I've been always very interested in Jesus as a, you know, oral storytelling Jewish man in Galilee under the oppression of the Roman Empire. So, and how does that man, that real person, become the figurehead of the very thing he seems to be opposing, which is empire and actually agriculture, I would say. So like, how does he become kind of the figurehead of the thing that kills him, that assassinates him? And so I spent a lot of my life really, really diving into the sociopolitical circumstances of that specific story. Like, you know, the spiritual inheritance, you know, the mythologems of the Mediterranean basin, really interested in Jesus as historical figure in a historical context. And I wrote a novel about that, actually, The Madonna Secret, that's coming out this summer. And as I was doing that research, I kept thinking that Jesus seems to have, he shares so much in common with these earlier vegetal gods of the Mediterranean, Attis, Adonis, Osiris, even Orpheus, Dionysus, and yet he doesn't ever get to fully flower into his potentiality, his chaotic, anti-imperial, festive, bodacious self, that he kind of gets clipped in the bud and he interrupts the cycle. So he's kind of like a tragedy. He's not kind of, he is a tragedy. I actually think it's really powerful and healing to begin to look at that story not as a miracle, but as a tragedy. And that what does it mean when we fetishize a tragedy? What happens to cultures when that becomes their nucleus, their orientation? And for me, as I came out of writing that novel, which took probably like 8 years of research, 3 years of writing, really big time expenditure, I was thrust deep into quarantine and into like radical isolation, health issues, just a lot of uncertainties. And the book wasn't selling, my novel. And so I kind of thought, you know, who's the healthier Jesus? I think I need to spend some time with the healthier Jesus. And so I started to, like, I'd done a lot of research about Dionysus for years as related to Jesus, as being on a rhizomatic continuity mythologically, culturally. But I started to actually, like, pray to Dionysus. I was at a point in my life where I thought, like, you know, I need a different deity. I need a different orientation. Like, my life has been very ordered. And that kind of enforced asceticism has been necessitated by health issues, by a lot of, like, you know, very real circumstances, but I need to pray to a god of chaos. I need to mulch my life, make it sexier, more embodied, more beautiful, more unpredictable. And so it was like truly kind of me praying to Dionysus, you know, researching him, really like orienting away from studying Jesus to going back to his healthier version in Dionysus. And as I did that, I started to see things in my life finally slip into place, like a joint out of place. Yeah, I mean, it was chaotic, it was unpredictable, but what a dance partner. What's your relationship to Dionysus?
So I was really into the Greek yeah. mythology when I was younger, so there's some of that. Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy was a big like interaction with Dionysus for me, like the Dionysian versus Apollonian perspective.
Yeah.
But I think what's most germane to this show and to my life now in my relationship to Dionysus is these Dionysian festivals, mm-hmm. the ecstatic trance that mm-hmm. kind of predated Greek theater, and the catharsis of Greek theater originally was born in these Dionysian festivals.
Yes.
And I'm feeling Dionysus right now. And I love that you talk about him as an agent of chaos, kind of trickster energy. I also like that he's like an androgynous rock star.
Yeah.
Like I really identify with that vibe. Now, I know your work and you would never try to say that one figure would reclaim masculinity or that Dionysus is even one figure. But if there's archetypal energy that could infuse modern masculinity, if you just took one or an example of one, Dionysus to me, you know, and to the point of your book, The Flowering Wand, Dionysus with his wand and his festivals to me, is a beautiful agent of changing the story about masculinity.
You know, it's interesting. I think of Dionysus as being like this incredible Trojan horse, which is he looks like an individual. He looks like one god, but really he's interspecies. He's, you know, he's twice born, thrice born, born as a goat, born as a bull, that he's sometimes a woman, that he's always trans, in transition between species, between genders, between behaviors. Sometimes he's good. Sometimes he's incredibly complicated and morally robust. And so he's kind of a Trojan horse for a biodiversity of masculinities. That, like, once you let him into the conversation, he brings a lot of other potentialities along with him.
I love the expression a biodiversity of masculinity. And I'm going to go to another Greek story for what I feel is a poverty of masculinity. So I grew up on the Odyssey. That was my earliest understanding of an aspirational masculinity, what it means to be a man. And to me, there was kind of two choices. You had Achilles or you had Odysseus. And Achilles is kind of like the man of brawn and the fighter, and and he's got his Achilles heel. And then you have Odysseus, who's the many-minded Odysseus. In the oral tradition, he's often referred to by an adjective that refers to generally like metacognition and often translated to many-minded. Yeah. So it's like the man of the mind. And for me,
of the many turns, aspiration,
yeah, many turns. Yeah, exactly. And for me, aspirational masculinity as a little boy was like, I could choose Achilles or I could choose Odysseus. And both of which to me now seem like a poverty of choice, for one thing, and the idea that it would be one thing and that it would be so binary. But when I think about how I grew up and what I thought the way to be in the world was, it was to be like Odysseus. That was my choice. And also to be on this epic journey. This, which, you know, the hero's journey, now the healing journey. So for me, this kind of like starting place of masculinity was really Odysseus. And I'm curious whether, I'm sure you have a perhaps a richer perspective of Odysseus than I do now, but how do you feel Odysseus sits within your understanding of these different kinds of Greek figures, like Dionysus? As you say that Dionysus is many things and perhaps many different gods. What's your take on Odysseus?
Are you ready for an hour? I just gave a lecture about Odysseus and the composition of the Odyssey. So this is very much what I'm in right now. So I think that Odysseus and the Odyssey have been impoverished by chirographic paradigms, by a written culture, and also by 20th century Joseph Campbell-esque ideas of linear narrative. But that's not actually how the Odyssey exists or was composed. That the Odyssey is actually kind of the antithesis of the hero's journey. It's actually composed like Russian nesting dolls. It's episodic, paratactical, that it doesn't have a linear progression. In fact, each episode is nested within another that then is retold in order to make room for the next one. And so it kind of totally disobeys a Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, which is very interesting to me. So Odysseus, for me, there's the Odysseus of modern interpretation, and then there's the Odysseus that might have actually existed within the oral storytelling rhapsodic tradition. So do you know about the rhapsodes?
No.
So the rhapsodes, so in the Mediterranean basin, and then, you know, kind of enriched by the Greek, by Greek culture, are the rhapsodes, who, and the rhapsoidos means to stitch the songs together. And it was the oral storytelling tradition where you would remember an epic, you would master it. So there was no Homer. Homer is a monomyth. Homer, Milman Perry, who is this groundbreaking classicist, showed that there probably was no specific Homeric author. There was a Homeric tradition. And that if you look at how the Odyssey is composed, it's actually composed about those things that we actually problematize as, you know, cliches, as repetitive speech and epithets. And so the way the Odyssey is composed is around the conservation of memory, that you want easily remembered episodes, characters, mnemonic devices that help you stitch the episodes together each time you retell it. However, it gives you enough open space to be able to correctly adapt the episodes and the stories to a changing political climate and audience. So each time the Odyssey was probably retold by a different person, it was changed a little bit. And it was constructed so it could be nested together differently each time. And there's this common misconception about oral storytelling that it's memorization. And actually, most anthropological studies of oral traditions that still exist today, there's no rote memorization. It's about improvisation around set episodes and episodes. And so we have a lot of, you know, misconceptions about oral culture and how it remained durable and adaptable. And so for me, the Odyssey is actually hyper-representative of a much healthier culture that through a modern interpretation, we've managed to fossilize. And the truth is that the Odyssey was a story that never ended. It had no end. It was cyclical. It would be retold each time. And in fact, one of the two main figures of the Odyssey are not Odysseus, but Athena and Penelope. Athena, the goddess of virgins, virgin meaning whole woman, not meaning maiden, but meaning woman who has, you know, total responsibility for herself, and also the goddess of weaving. And so Penelope weaves the shroud and then unweaves it each night so that she defers the suitors. But what that is doing, if we go back to the idea of weaving, stitching the songs together, is she puts the story together and then she takes it apart. Because to finish the story is to say that Odysseus is never going to get home, that we have to unstitch our stories in order to stitch them back together again, that to complete the story is to die, that to keep unstitching it and then putting it back together anew each night with different circumstances and different voices is to keep it infused with aliveness. So I actually feel like the Odyssey, if we replant it within its context and within its actual tradition, becomes this incredible antidote to the hero's journey, which is how can we undo our stories every night? How can we decay in order to regrow? And how can we understand that, you know, life doesn't happen along an arrow of causality. It's spiralic. It's episodic. It's life nested with another life.
Wow. I so much want to be able to unweave the stories and then weave them again in a playful improvisational dance.
Me too.
Because I don't want to not have a story.
No.
I like having stories and I like living into archetypes and I like these adventures. But what I find with the modern healing journey is I have a wound, and I must go through a series of arduous tasks. In this case, it's often like indigenous medicines. It's you know, these like Vipassana or whatever. I've got to go through these series of tasks and then I will somehow reach a place of healing. But I think that what actually ends up happening is that by this preoccupation with this, as you say, this causal linear path, what you're actually doing is in your mind, you're telling the same story over and over again. You're not making room for a new story. And the same story is, I have a wound. That's wound I need to heal, but your mind wants to keep doing the healing thing, so it's not going to give you something that actually heals it. And each sort of cathartic moment of realization is followed by its natural sort of neurochemical drop, and you're like, oh, wait, no, I'm not healed at all. And so you're trying to leap from peak experience to peak experience as if at some point you will rest on the mountaintop. And it just doesn't work that way. So people end up getting discouraged. And the whole process ends up being this super consumptive thing of like, I've got to drink more ayahuasca. It's much more exciting to think of unweaving and then weaving new stories, like Dionysus getting to be a woman and then, but not necessarily staying
a woman. No, in fact, like, you're always moving. Life stays alive by moving. When something stops, it's dead. And I think that's why I find modern conceptions of identity politics a little ossified, which is that identity should keep moving. You shouldn't have to fix and prove and perform one identity. You should let it lunate. You know, one day you're waxing, the next you're waning. Let your identity lunate.
Well, and I would like for myself and for the people that I speak to about this to have more play and joy and optimism. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like we're living a story right now of climate degradation, of, you know, late stage capitalism, hyper individuality. We're taking psychedelics to somehow position ourselves as maybe a messianic in the healing of this thing. But in the end, it just seems like many of us are very lost in terms of what should we do with our human bodies in this moment that doesn't lead to further alienation or atomization. And I love myth and the way you were talking about the Odyssey, as in with each retelling, it takes on aspects of the current climate. I like myth for that reason. Myth is kind of like a way of orienting oneself.
Yeah.
However, I feel like the mythic viewpoint can kind of get minimized into this obsession with archetypes and men's work and shadow work. So there's just this instinct, I think, to kind of like narrow and make things predictable. And that's probably because that's the way our brains were trained as little kids. But I think myth seems to be a richness. What is an antidote to this hyper-individual obsession with self hero's journey in order to heal some sort of wound that is just replicating itself. Where would you tell people to go in this moment?
So many answers, but I think I'll focus with myself. You know, I'm not an expert on everything, but I'm becoming more familiar with my own quirks. So maybe I'll situate myself there, which is, so I have a genetic condition that is incurable. So I'm immediately exiled from the healing narrative where you get a diagnosis and then you get a medicine and you feel better. And I think a lot of people at this point have, you know, psychological or physical conditions without a definitive etiology that come from, you know, sedimented oppression, that there's no way that they're going to be individually responsible for their health and then be able to change anything, because, you know, it's like curing the fish and then throwing it back into a poisoned ocean. How can we expect healing to happen in individuals when it's a complex network of oppression that we're not personally responsible for? So for me, I have this condition that has no cure. And, you know, for a long time, it didn't have a diagnosis. And still, so I still had that kind of optimistic sense that maybe there would be some alleviation. There would be some healing narrative where I was delivered to wellness again, the kingdom of wellness. But the truth is that, you know, I oftentimes say to be well in this culture is to be isolated, to be unwell is to be relational. Because the truth is, when, you know, I always problematize that word codependent, which has become kind of like a figurehead of pop psychology on Instagram. The truth is that everything is interdependent, that self is only self through other. And that when you can't walk, when you can't bathe yourself, and you can't take care of yourself, you see that the fiction of the self is just that, a fiction. That we are dependent on other beings to eat, to breathe. And that it's this relationality that intimately strings us into the experiences, the umwelts, the sensory worlds of other beings. That it is, you know, a great responsibility and a great beauty to depend on other beings to take care of you. And so when I found out that I have connective tissue disease without a cure, I suddenly realized, oh, well, I've been obsessed with fungi, which are the connective tissue of the earth and the soil for years. So maybe my healing won't happen inside this skin silhouette, inside my selfhood, but maybe it will happen interstitially at the interface between me and many other beings. Maybe if I advocate for fungi, learn about mycorrhizal systems, begin to highlight them in my work, weave them into my work, my healing will happen in my extended body, my extended network. And the metaphor I always use is that, you know, we've conflated mind with brain and self with, you know, individual body. But the truth is we are all extended networks. That, you know, Aboriginal culture, you know, memory never exists inside an individual or even in a human community. It exists in the overlap between human population and landscape, that you offload your cultural memory into landscape. So, you know, body is always body plus. Mind is always mind plus body plus other bodies. And I love that the spider, in extended cognition research, the spider creates its web. And then if you damage part of the web, neuroscientists have shown that the spider acts as if it's had brain damage. It's had a stroke. So what we're beginning to realize is that the spider's brain, its mind, extends into its web. That so its prosthesis, this thing that it produces and excretes, that then it receives stimuli, wind, pollen, flies, that is the extended network of the spider. So I like to say to people that you live in place, in a real place, and you breathe in the air full of pheromone, microbiome, funk, other beings. You're eating the food, hopefully grown in place. You're responsible for place. Maybe you're planting your actual excrement into place and re-entering into that food web. So your extended body is that place. You know, you're a spider in a web of kin. And so your healing might not happen inside of you, but it might happen in your advocacy for a lake nearby or for the invasive species that within a very colonial idea of conservation are getting demonized. But, you know, a way we can begin to mulch the hyper anthropocentric and individual approach to healing is to begin to see that we are leaky, we are porous, we are always chimerical, becoming other.
Mm. Is there a role for the festival in this process?
Oh yeah.
You know, when you right? So when you talked about the spider web, mm-hmm. and the interaction between the spider's mind and the web, I think about the heightened serendipity we have in the kind of closed container festivals. So like camping participatory events, most especially like Burning Man is the kind of like marquee example of this. But there's this heightened serendipity in those spaces. There's this way of people meeting. There's ways that things kind of cathart and kind of burp out of people's psyches in those spaces. So I feel like the technology of the festival is super valuable. And yet, you know, let's take Burning Man, for example. You're spending a bunch of money, you're being super wasteful to go to this inhospitable desert to then enact this ritual. And this ritual is something we feel like we really need because we're not experiencing it in our daily lives. But we're going away to a place we call home. And then we're finally like with our people in that space, but it happens once a year and it requires a lot of consumption in order to do that. So it's an interesting matter because there's something that our souls are really longing for. And maybe we are trying to get that at Coachella, you know, depending on where we're at in our relationship to kind of the commercial world. But we're craving this thing, and yet it's kind of a problematic expression of it in certain ways. So
yeah,
how do you feel about the technology of the festival as it sits in the modern world, and how can we improve upon it? What do we want to do with the festival?
Well, this is a great question. I love when I get asked a question that I'm thinking about that no one's asked me. So the technology of putting lots of bodies together in place where they're mirror neuroning, they're breathing together, their actual somatic organismic selves are beginning to become an extended body. I'm sure you've read The History of Collective Joy by Barbara Ehrenreich.
I have not, and I must.
It's the book for you, which is basically like across cultures, vast periods of time, healing used to be about putting bodies together to sing and move together. And there was the understanding that there are emotions and experiences that cannot be held by a single body. The only way they can be held is when you distribute them through a concatenation of bodies that are dancing and moving the cultural lymph. And so I think that the technology of putting bodies together in song and prayerful experience where they're moving the lymph in their own bodies, they're sweating, they're excreting. So I love the idea of mirror neuroning too, which is a kind of a kaleidoscopic empathy that happens when you put bodies together, which is mirror neuroning is when you look at someone and you begin to actually imitate them unconsciously. And as you imitate their bodies, you have an understanding of their interoceptive experience, their internal experience. So we kind of demonize imitating people inside of our culture, but it's actually one of our best technologies for understanding the internal experience of another being. It's how babies learn. Babies look at their mothers and they mirror neuron. They begin to like actually move their bodies to learn like what emotion is associated with that movement. So people with Botox actually have much less empathic ability. They're not as skilled at reading other people's emotional experiences because they can't move their faces to mirror neuron. It's really interesting. So I'm interested in a kind of when you put together a lot of different people who are all mirror neuroning with each other, you are kind of oscillating through different consciousnesses, different experiences. So it moves the self, it massages the self, it gives you a little bit more flexibility. You know, that's why people take psychedelics to kind of open up their sensory gating. You can also do that by dancing and singing with a lot of other people. That's another way of, you know, lowering that default mode network restriction. However, what you said about how it becomes paired with this kind of consumptive anthropocentric festival idea where you're traveling to a place you don't know, you're sitting on top of land you don't have a relationship with to have this human experience for human culture. You know, healing should always be about healing of people in community and place. That if your healing isn't also directly affecting the ecology you're in, it's not real healing. It's this kind of narcissistic loop. And so for me, this isn't just a problem of festival, it's a problem of environmentalism, which is you take a plane to advocate for a charismatic cause a country away instead of doing the very unphotographable job of advocating for the field behind your house, which is, you know, if we're really going to do festival as healing, it's going to have to be contextual, in place, with the community that is actually around you. You know, the people who have a different political ideology, the people who are difficult. How can we create festival as ecotone? So I love the ecotone as metaphor, which is it's that place where, you know, the field meets the forest and there's a hedge. where the ocean meets the sand and there's like the tidal pools. And it's usually a place of high biodiversity. It's where species begin to diversify. Usually it's an incredibly fertile thickness, like a living boundary. But it's also, ecotone comes from the word eco, oikos for house, and tonos for tension. It's a place where tensions are held and not dissolved. And so the biodiversity, the kind of the enrichment of evolutionary creativity happens not by creating a community where everyone's the same, where everyone has the same kind of political orientation and the same outfit. You know, I think Burning Man is kind of almost like, as I've never been, I've only ever seen it from afar, but it's a lot of sameness. You know, people who share a lot of the same orientations go to the same place. And I think that an ecotone is about holding the tension with things that are actually in your ecosystem and asking for your attention, but are very different than you. So it's like those gradients between the, you know, the meadow and the forest that create the real festivity, I think. So I've been thinking about that in my own, you know, location in the Hudson Valley, where there are a lot of artists and thinkers and people who I enjoy. And there are also people who need healing desperately. You know, we're having serious opioid issues. There are people who are getting pushed out by gentrification, who've lived here for years. Now people from the city are moving up and pushing them out. So there's a lot of complexity. There's pain. And what would it mean to create a festival in place here that was responding to the ecology of the Hudson Valley, feeding it, but also not dissolving the tensions of the people involved?
What you're describing now makes me think of something that you said. I think it was on Ian McKenzie's Mythic Masculine podcast, but you said, we should wed our wounds to the wounds we have created in the earth.
Yeah.
That's a line that really struck me in terms of our secret, special, individual, personal wound that requires going inward. And there's probably a mommy and daddy thing in there somewhere. Yeah. But really, the mommy and daddy thing is just like ancestral wounding that's from our lineage anyway. Dad wounds you, but that's because dad was wounded. And back in the day, Irish convicts sent to Australia. You know, like that's my personal story. But really, we should wet our wounds to the wounds we've created in the earth.
Yeah.
To me, that's very compelling. A moment ago, you were kind of beginning to speak about this, but I wonder if you could get even a little more specific about what does it mean to wed our wounds to the wounds we've created in the earth? Like, how do we take, you know, my issue with depression, how do I wed that to the earth?
Yeah, so this is something that is high stakes, and I really feel alongside you, which is that if the earth knows how to hold me when I'm feeling terrible, if there are places that are big enough to hold the emotional weather that I have experienced that has been enough to destroy a psyche or a body, I have to learn how to give the same thing back bodily, somatically. And this can be, you know, it can be very practical, which is advocacy, you know, really protecting landscape, advocating for species that are going extinct. It can be, you know, that very easily demonstrable action. But it can also be outside of the dominant paradigm. It can be about feeding yourself to the land. So for me, I have known some intense trauma in my life. And I'm living on a place in the Hudson Valley where the Esopus Wars happened, where there was mass genocide that then was really erased from the history books. Like, it is so hard to find the primary documents that show what the Dutch did to the Munsee Lenape where I'm living, like exactly where I'm living. Like, the Esopus Wars started like probably within half a mile of my house. And it's like some of the worst bloodshed that happened during the colonization of this area, and yet it's erased. And like, you know, the only documents I can find are some of the most hideous things I've ever read. So I experienced violence as a child, as a young child. And so I've been very wedded to people who take advantage of animals and young children who can't advocate for themselves and can't take care of themselves. And what happened in the Rondau, where I am in Kingston, is young babies were taken into the water and used as marks boards for soldiers throwing knives. And the mothers were made to watch right at the river where I live and go every morning to run and say my prayers. And so I was thinking about how, you know, a lot of people have psychotic breaks down by the river where I live. Like, they're just always crazy people. They like kind of congregate there. And I'm a kind of crazy person and I moved here. And I sometimes think that the land, so also the land here, it was burned, it was razed, it was monocropped. You know, the people were killed. The people who had an intimate dialogue to the land were killed. Those stories were erased. The blood was put into the ground and then concretized. There's concrete poured over that blood. There is no memorial, no understanding. And so I've been brought here to begin to process that undigested pain. And so have the people who find their bodies here having some kind of non-normative psychological experience. That I think sometimes we think of, you know, mental illness as being this personal experience, but you know, the land, when it's not getting to speak, will use its our bodies as mouthpieces. That in many other traditions, there's an understanding that we are, you know, divine horsemen in the Vuduan tradition, that, you know, we have to learn how to be possessed. That we don't, when we don't know how to let the energy ride us and move through us, that's when mental illness becomes an affliction. But can we let that energy move through us? And so very personally, I've thought about, how do I let the energy, the stuck violence of the Esopus Wars, move through my work? So I do that through dance. I do it through running through this area. Sometimes I've been planting adaptogenic mushrooms that have been grown for me or that I've grown into the landscape. So adaptogens, when you take them into your body, they have a targeted approach. So they don't do a specific thing to your body. They go in and tailor the response to what's wrong with your immune system, which is so generous and intuitive. So that, you know, ashwagandha is an adaptogen, reishi, and they're incredible medicines. And so I've been thinking about adaptogenic medicine in general with this area, which is, can I plant my body and can I plant actual adaptogens in the land ceremonially to say, like, can I help your immune system come back into regulation? Can I lie on you sometimes and feel the ways you are outside of your window of tolerance? So I think it's kind of, you risk looking really goofy. You have to use your whole body, I think. I think that we all need to encourage each other to look foolish, that the ceremonies that are required are sometimes not the ones that do things, but they use our whole organism.
And I think that there are opportunities for festivals with their space for silliness to allow us to
definitely
at least learn how to use our whole bodies.
And I think festivals used to be a way of honoring the land and letting that energy come through a conduit. That you know, it's safer when there's really big land energy somewhere. It's safer to have 100 people channeling it than just one person.
You and I both have a passion for healing masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And the horrific example you just gave of these men, and I know that they were men who killed these babies. I'm curious about these men, and I'm curious about that ancestral thread of masculinity. And how did we get to a place where men behaved that way? And we're still living with those wounds, and men are still behaving that way. Why do men behave this way? And what can we do to heal that with compassion and love for the damage in the masculine psyche that has moved through generations?
So I want to move slowly through this so that each step is compassionate and moss soft. I think that, you know, the violence I experienced as a child was at the hands of men. So I think that a very simplistic, easy reaction is that men have done this violence. Men are the people who are responsible. And I think patriarchy is an easy term to throw around, but I think lately I've been softening around it and thinking it's dominator culture. It's anthropocentric, human supremacist culture. And that, you know, we always want to offload the responsibility off onto someone else. But the truth is that the real wounded beings are not humans right now. They are everything else. And we have all been responsible for that. That the world itself are those children down at the river, and we are the perpetrators, all of us. I mean, not all of us. And, you know, it's a kind of Euro-patriarchal orientation that's done this. It's a colonial apparatus. So, you know, the responsibility for this is not evenly distributed. But for a lot of us, the way that we have lived has wounded the infants of the more than human world. And so I think that I see men in my life who have had a very impoverished experience of what their life can look like because they've only been given like two stories. And so I think we can be really compassionate to the people who identify as male in our lives, that they have not been given good stories to live out. So when they make bad decisions, it's because they were not given a lot of options. And, you know, when you have a gut that doesn't have a lot of microbes in it, a monologuing pathogen can take over. And the way you cure that is not by killing the monologuing pathogen, but by adding fermentation, adding like probiotics, more stuff in, better stuff. And so I think that I want to give the masculine a big probiotic hug and say, you know, you need a lot more options. You need options that come from fungi, from lizards, from weather systems, from different cultures. We need to have, you know, holobiont masculinity stories. Holobiont meaning beings that are composed of other beings. But that I don't want to put the sole responsibility for the violence we're confronting right now onto masculinity. That masculinity can become a scapegoat for something that is really human supremacist. That the problem for me has been, when I look at the history of ecocidal behavior, is beings that begin to think that they don't need other beings to stay alive and other beings can belong to them. And that seems to be the paradigm we need to heal. And that's not just men needing to do the work. That's all of us needing to join hands in festival. I love, I think it might be Tony K. Bambara, or it might be Adrienne Marie Brown via Tony K. Bambara, says like the revolution must be pleasurable. Like you will not change the paradigm if you do not make it fun and sexy. Like the best way to do this and to change this paradigm is not punitive. Is not by making people feel shame. It is by saying you are held and we are going to hold this together and there is going to be good food and good drink.
I love that. I love that it needs to be sexy and compelling.
Yeah.
I so appreciate not scapegoating the masculine, and yet there are particular antidotes needed in masculinity specifically. So I want to stay on this a little
bit
because this has been an area of study for me as well. But the idea of making the work sexy is so important. I like the androgynous rock star as like a way of kind of culture jamming gender, because the rock star is so sort of like aspirational, but there's kind of like this David Bowie weirdness that like can compel us to kind of upend our more restricted ideas of masculinity. And that brings us back to Dionysus. You're talking about we need fermentation in the dysbiosis of the masculine biome, right? And who better than the god of fermentation to come and bring that in? And I wonder if we can take a moment to talk about the sexiness of alternatives to traditional masculine presentation. Because it seems like what we have, and you said there's two, I think what we've got is we've got the kind of traditional masculine, we might call that toxic masculinity today. We have this sensitive new age guy whose best thing he can possibly do for the feminine is to cut off his own dick. Like that's basically, you know, how can I serve the feminine? Let me cut off my penis, because my penis is the tool of danger. And you're for me at least, I grew up and it was like, I wanted to do the toxic masculinity thing because that was what being a man was. I want to exile any feminine in me. And then there's a switching moment where it's like the Sneetches from Dr. Seuss. The star on my belly was this kind of traditional masculinity, but then it was like the sensitive new age guy, so you got to take the star off. And now it seems like there's this idea of this integrated masculine where it's a lot about shadow work, but it still feels kind of monolithic and sort of an aspirational doing. So when I look at like what it means to be in a male body and to quite like masculinity as a thing to explore and play with, but also have a lot of feminine energy in me, I still feel myself needing to, and maybe this is even like the hero's journey too, is like I need to go towards one thing that is the right thing, that is the way of winning. Help us not do that, please.
Well, that's a big responsibility. I will offer some of the beings that have helped me. I think that we're so stuck inside a human idea of gender and gender dualism that we forget that nature is very queer and creative and not nostalgic and always changing. That if you look at archetypes in nature, they are in movement. That to have a stable archetype in nature is to stop evolving. That you need, that, you know, masculinity will stay healthy if it keeps changing. And that species that stop changing are not adapted to changing climatological and environmental pressures. And so the one thing I'll say is, like, we need to mulch this and see that we are, everything we think that belongs to us solely as humans is on a rhizome with many other beings. And so the inheritance I always want to gift back to the masculine is the theriomorph. And the theriomorph comes from, you know this term?
No, I was just very excited because of how much I didn't know the term.
So it's a Greek term from theri meaning beast, and morphe meaning to change. And theriomorphs are beings, they were usually men actually in iconography, and the earliest cave paintings were beings who were half animal, half man. So we have Chiron, you know, Dionysus with his bullhorns and his snakes is often a theriomorph. And there's this very simplistic modern idea that if we look back at the earliest material culture, the art, we see the divine feminine. But actually we see, first and foremost, we see the absence of humans, mostly, that we're not actually interested in divine masculine or divine feminine. We're interested in other beings and ourselves woven into a tapestry, a polyphony of other voices. So there's that we are inside a ecology rather than an atomized hero. And then the earliest demonstrations of humans are not stable genders or divinities, but theriomorphs. You know, the trois frères shaman in the caves in France, and the lion man found in Germany, I think 37,000 years old, 40,000 years old. And they are, you know, the trois frères shaman has an owl face, male genitalia, hoofs, a fur, paws, pelt, like very in between, very hybrid. And so I like to think about men as being the needle that stitches the world of nature and the world of human culture together. So the great demonstration of this is the figure of Merlin, who comes from a bardic tradition of Taliesin, Amerigen, all of these different figures of bards or prophets that go mad, that embody the minds of animals, like literally are transformed into corn and hawks and salmons in order to get their spiritual inheritance. So they don't get their enlightenment or their ascendancy by like meditating. They get it by being other beings, by inhabiting the minds of other beings. You learn how to be human, not by being human, but by being other beings. And so the best example, I think, is Merlin, who is the advisor to King Arthur or to kings. That actually in the earliest Welsh annals, he probably was some amalgamation of real historical figures who were all like put into one figure, like Homer. And so he advised many different kings. But he gives advice on how to rule the kingdom, not by being in the kingdom, but by going mad and going into the forest. And so what he does is he weaves together the two worlds. He makes sure that there's never a boundary that holds, that there's always some semi-porosity. And so I think the theriomorph as being half man and half human is a real rich inheritance for men to take back on, which is that men can be like other beings. That masculinity is actually perhaps an intelligence for being non-masculine. That what it is it's a deep emotional flexibility. And that, like, can men practice being like fungi, like eels, like naked mole rats, you know? Can men become the mouthpieces for orchids, you know, for viruses, for bacteria? That I think men are incredible conduits for other voices. And a great example is, a kind of macabre example, is the ant. There's a fungi called Ophiocordyceps unilateralis that takes over ants, infects their bodies, and coordinates their movements. It actually doesn't take over their brains. It just takes over their neurochemical experience. It infuses their body with different chemicals and changes their behavior and forces them to climb up these stalks of plants, bite into a leaf. And then at that point, they're effectively, as Merlin Sheldrake says, a fungus in an ant costume. And they sporulate a mushroom out of their heads. And so it's a pretty painful example, but it might be what the masculine is being invited to do, which is its inheritance, which is to become a mouth for other beings, to become a theriomorph again. And that I think the masculine, if you look at Dionysus and you look at all of these different beings that were popular in the Mediterranean basin and also in many different indigenous populations, that oftentimes what we call the shaman is really just a being who has a really good creative somatic ability to behave and move and think and sing and howl and purr like other beings.
Sophie, this is so inspiring to me right now. I just want you to know, like, this, for me personally, in my own life, this is really special. The first time that I really took, like broke out of my gender binary in a public manner was dressing as a bunny.
Oh, I love that.
So it was Halloween, which is a wonderful time to kind of turn things on their head.
Yeah.
I was the White Rabbit from Alice in Wonderland, but I wanted to be like a woman. But dressing in drag just seemed like too much for me, because if I were to dress in drag, then I would see my maleness as grotesque to me.
Yeah.
And I was like terrified of that. The idea that I would be this kind of, and this is obviously so much negative conditioning from growing up in the 80s and 90s in the US, and the fear of being seen as gay, and like all of this bad programming, right? But the idea of actually dressing in drag to me was too much of an affront to my masculinity. But I wanted to express being a feminine being. And so the access point to that for me was to be a bunny. And to inhabit bunny characteristics. And I was a feminine bunny. I was very, like, I wore a corset and I had like makeup with this little whiskers and stuff. And I have a photo of it where I feel like I look very beautiful in a feminine way, which I don't think I could have felt that way about myself if I hadn't used like an animal as kind of avatar. And I found it super liberating. I also, for the males listening to this podcast who have not tried dressing in this way, it gave me a lot of understanding and compassion for women for people who are expressing femininity in public. Like, people were like touching me without asking. And I knew that happened, but it hadn't happened to me. So it was like, it was super interesting to like have this feminine experience. But the only access point that I could get my kind of like conditioned psyche into that was through this portal of the bunny. The bunny is like, for me, it's kind of like the avatar of a certain kind of like innocent femininity.
That's beautiful. And I think that if we widen that understanding, you know, we're looking to heal these gender wounds inside of human culture, but sometimes the best place to heal them is in other beings, in our relationship to being other beings. That, you know, maybe the masculine doesn't need to dress as a woman, but it needs to just practice being, you know, bunnies and raccoons and snakes. And maybe we'll have, you know, it's not just about an empathic imagination that extends to other human beings. It extends well beyond that. I love that. That the access point for healing for a lot of us doesn't have to be other humans. It can be other beings.
I want to come back to something from a while ago in the conversation, mm-hmm. where you talked about your relationship with your own health.
Yeah.
And you told me that you felt that you could find healing interstitially.
Yeah.
You could, rather than, you know, you were diagnosed with an incurable disease, and so you were like, okay, well, how do I heal this? How is that going? What have you learned from that approach that other people might benefit from, who are also like, oh, I could try that? How has it been working for you to try that? And what have you learned?
Well, I am finishing my book right now, which will come out in 2025, called The Body is a Doorway, Healing Beyond Hope and the Human, which is just about this question. And I think that the answer to the question is that there is no answer. There is a lived, enforced presentism. There is a being now, a being here with that, you know, there are times when this type of tricky embodiment is cool and interesting and allows me into experiences that people with normative bodies might not otherwise get. I oftentimes say that the neurodivergent body, the traumatized body, the sick body is a compass out of an anthropocentric narrative. That, you know, the things about the ways in which our bodies glitch that we refer to as a problem are oftentimes actually ways that we are being sensitive to the world that other people are sensory gating out. That when you're hypersensitive, maybe you're noticing the weather patterns, the fluctuations in the light, in the climate that other people get to willingly not pay attention to. That you're attuned to, environmentally embedded with your ecology in a way that people who are well are not. So I oftentimes say that, you know, being on the front line of evolution, that, you know, evolution doesn't happen in this kind of correct way, that, you know, it's always a glitch that becomes an adaption. So, you know, if your body is breaking, it's also experimenting with embodiment. But being on the front line of that experimentation is not easy or fun or pleasurable. And so can we stay with the discomfort? Can we stay with the trouble, to summon Donna Haraway? Can we begin to help each other stay with this discomfort and look at what it's forcing us to pay attention to? That there are a lot of experiences that if we were well, we would never give them the time of day. But if we're held in shapes by the nature of our conditions, we're being asked to pay attention to something that we wouldn't otherwise look at. And that might be a being, it might be a species, it might be something that passes unnoticed. So I oftentimes like to say, like, what are you being oriented towards? Because you have no other choice and you did not order this off the menu. I never want to suggest that these experiences of initiation are something that other people should want or have. But if you have them and you can't resolve them, then how can you begin to alchemize them and use them as an orientation, as a kind of like compass? So that's how I navigate it with my life. But gosh, it's inscrutable. It is difficult on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I think lately I oftentimes notice that I'm between stories, that one story has ended and the other hasn't necessarily begun. And I think our culture tells us that to be between stories is dangerous, that, you know, a traumatized body wants an answer now, that when it doesn't understand what's happening in its surrounding, it wants to control and understand as quickly as possible. But that means that you oftentimes jump from one bad story to another bad story. And so I love to use the metaphor of hermit crabs, that they don't produce their shells. They actually steal them from snails or other beings, but they outgrow them. So when they outgrow a shell, they'll usually find another shell that's also incorrectly sized, and they'll exit the last shell and stand next to the incorrectly sized shell and wait as this little fleshy, unprotected organism. And slowly, over a period of hours, a bunch of hermit crabs will coalesce, and then they will all perform something called a vacancy chain, which you can look up online if you want to see it, which it's amazing. And they all exchange shells at once, so that they all end up in the right shell. But it means that there's this period of time where you have to wait outside of your shell, no old story, no new story. Very, very vulnerable, very scary. And so I think for me, how can we begin to hold each other in this moment individually and also culturally, where we are between stories? I think our culture wants a new story right now, really quickly. And I oftentimes see that this fixation on AI is that kind of traumatized cultural body wanting a new uncertainty, a new God. Like, we feel like we understand everything, so, and we feel like AI is like the new thing we don't understand, so we're going to pray to it. Like, most of the conversations about AI seem like thinly veiled theology. Like, these are the new cults. Like, I actually think if you compare the rhetoric of, like, people talking about AI to, like, scholastic medieval theologians, like, very little difference. It seems like the same thing. We're just looking for kind of a cataphatic experience of God. How can we circumscribe the uncertainty that we cannot touch? And I think instead of shifting into that distraction, how can we begin to hold each other in our glitchy, disturbed, polluted, microplastic threaded bodies in between shells and wait for the right size shell to come? And I think that happens through ritual, through circles, through prayer, through communal experiences of storytelling, holding each other, exchanging shells.
That is such a cool metaphor. I wasn't aware that hermit crabs did that.
We do. It's so cool.
And I love the liminal position, you know, like the caterpillar that becomes mush, yeah. Like that moment of mush. And how can we stay with the moment of mush until the actual proper shell is available?
Yeah.
Because the instinct is to get into another shell that's too small.
Yeah.
So it's like we leave the shell of Christianity and enter the shell of New Ageism.
Yeah.
And, you know, and God becomes the universe and sin becomes karma and
right?
Praying becomes manifesting. Yeah. Right. But it's the same, it's the shell's the same shape.
Yeah. I mean, I think Christianity and science. I mean, oftentimes I'm like, gosh, you think you're into science? It's just, you know, Cartesian dualism is just, you know, early Christianity.
Well, and I think we're in a place too, talking about healing, where a shell that we're spontaneously becoming aware of leaving is the shell of pop culture therapy speak.
Yeah.
So like everything is trauma and we, you know, we're looking at Instagram and it's saying we got to self-care, let's self-care, self-care, self-care. And it seems literally in the past month or two, there seems to be a sort of large scale rebellion against that. There's a great podcast, The Emerald, did something on this.
Yeah, I know, Josh, yeah.
There was an article in the New York Times that was, I think it was the New York, or maybe the New Yorker, about therapy speak. And so there's a kind of courage in leaving our stories.
Yeah.
And a kind of wisdom in observing when we have outgrown them. And I think what you're offering here, which maybe this is a kind of meta shell in a way, but the ability to have multiple stories and be able to inhabit and explore them in a communal context. And I think that's why myth is so interesting, because mythology is really like a multiplicity of stories. They're in tension with each other. You can't just kind of take one story from like the entire pantheon of Greek mythology and say, look, this is what it means to be a man, or this is what it means to heal, or this is, you know, there's a kind of like tension between these different pieces. And I think I really like what you've done with the Flowering Wand in touching on these different moments and these different pieces, these different mythologies. And where this brings me to is that you are a well-studied individual, and you're, when I think of therapy speak, I like the way that you talk better than that. And so this is kind of an interesting question as a podcaster, but I can imagine that people are listening to this podcast right now and being like, I would like to have some of these frameworks and viewpoints that Sophie has. What should a listener be studying and reading and learning about to get a more of an orientation? Can you direct us how to think about the world a bit more like you?
So people often ask me how to become scientifically literate or ecologically literate or mythologically literate. And I oftentimes say that I'm not super interested in literacy. I'm interested in being a lover. And that there's an idea of comprehensive knowledge, which is very tied to capitalism, which is you will acquire knowledge, you will accumulate it, and then you will be proficient and you will have some kind of understanding, which is on a hierarchy, which is above other people's understanding. And I think that I always want to problematize the idea of expertise or complete knowledge, and also knowledge that can be transplanted from one place to another. So I always encourage people to love what you love and follow what you love, and trust that it will, like a bee going into a flower, you will incidentally pollinate things as you follow your desire. And you can't know everything. Follow the one being that you love. So maybe it's black bears. Like maybe you just really love black bears and trust that love. Like maybe you read the local mythology about them. Maybe you learn about their science. What's going on with them right now? How can you honor them? How can you spend time with them? What would it mean to live like a black bear? Like, you know, I think that we have forgotten how to give ourselves to other beings, to become a mouth for another being. And so there are plenty of ways you can read like me. You can, you know, you can read scientific studies or books about fungi, you know, whatever you want, but get intimate with where you are. Your best mentor will never be a human being. It will be the place underneath your feet. It will be the, you know, a teaspoon of dirt has millions of microbes and miles of mycorrhizal fungi. Like, that's a good teacher right there. Eat it. Like, literally, eat it. That's what you should do. Sleep with it beneath your pillow. We have thought, we have this idea that knowledge arrives to us through books, through teachers, through human beings. But, you know, the epistemologies of the world are much wider and more feral than we have given them credit for. That, you know, other traditions say, like, you go to a place, you sleep there, you're going to receive the dream. So maybe the best way to receive the knowledge is to go and sleep in a place that you want to learn from. That, you know, these things are seem goofy, but they are the best ways to weave ourselves back into intimacy. That, you know, court the land where you live like a lover, knowing that if you've heard it or not listened to it for a long time, it will need to be wooed. Like, bring it gifts, bring it coffee beans, tobacco, like a thimbleful of whiskey. Truly, that, you know, be a lover with your landscape. And that's the best way to learn. I mean, of course, I have bibliographies attached to all my books. I do podcasts. I have a Substack where I have, like, you know, tons of recommendations. And gosh, I'm a compost heap of my favorite thinkers and musicians and artists. And I always want people to pay attention to their work. But the most important work are the beings that are outside your window right now, or inside, like the potato bug in the corner of your room. Yeah. So I would say follow your desire, your love, your orientation, and trust that if you're paying attention to something, it's because it's paying attention to you.
Mm. And I love that at the end of our conversation here, you've upended Joseph Campbell once more.
Oh.
Because Joseph Campbell famously has this line of follow your bliss. Mm-hmm. And follow your bliss is a very individually oriented yeah. thing. It's like the Buddhist sort of like craving and aversion. Let me follow what makes me feel good, what makes me feel whole, what makes me feel a certain way. Bliss is a feeling. But what you're saying is follow what you love, go towards what you love and be in devotion and yeah. be in lovership to it. And that's relational, mm-hmm. which seems to be the story of this entire conversation.
Yeah.
Festivals as relational, healing as relational. And I think that that is such a beautiful insight. And then just a cherry on the top is like, if you're looking at it, it is looking at you.
Yeah, that real animism we need to reinvigorate, which is everything is bumptious and alive in a way that's different than us. And it's that difference that keeps us asking questions and reorienting out of our own solipsism.
Well, so Sophie, we're going to get a big dose of your work because we'll have it all in the show notes. And you mentioned that you are referencing a lot of thinkers who've yeah. inspired and influenced you. Give us the end of podcast, where we find you, what we should be paying attention to, and give us the full title of The Flowering Wand, because it's like it's a very big title. So where do people go from this conversation feeling inspired and wanting to learn more?
Well, first of all, this has been one of the best conversations I've had in recent times. So thank you for these really juicy yes. questions. And I hope that we can cross-pollinate and have many more conversations. Thank you.
Yes, totally in.
But where can people find me? So I have this book. Inner Traditions, my publisher forced me to shorten the title to Rewilding the Sacred Masculine, The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine. But the original title was Trans-Species Magicians, Rhizomatic Harpists, Lunar Kings, and Lycanized Lovers Heal the Masculine. A little maximalist. That's out.
But we need all of them. We need all of it, right?
All of the juice. But my wild, sexy Jesus book, which will probably get me crucified, my fictional retelling of the Gospels, The Madonna Secret, comes out this summer. I have a Substack, Make Me Good Soil. I have it free and paid. I try and offer a lot of work for free, a lot of essays and thinking for free, because I've been a starving artist. I understand how it is. I like my ideas to be able to flow. But if you want to support my work and get, you know, pieces of work that's in progress, you can sign up for the paid. And I teach classes and I'm going to announce a couple soon. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, all of that will be in the show notes. And yes, I definitely would love to continue to cross-pollinate with you. And I think so many of our listeners who go to festivals and who take psychedelics are looking for a similar way of breaking out of hyper-individuality. And arriving at the mountaintop of healing is not the way to do that. But being unhealed in relation seems to be. And I yeah. think that that's really what I'm taking from this conversation today.
Well, this has been an absolute joy, and I hope it's the beginning of many more. Thank you, Eamon.
Thank you so much, Sophie. Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you liked the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.